G'day, g'day, guys. Now, before we dive into today's show, I want to ask you a few quick questions. Are you looking to take your investing career to the next level? Are you wanting an accountability partner who will push you to achieve your goals? Are you needing to surround yourself with successful investors and entrepreneurs in order to up your game and take control of your life? Well, if you've answered yes to any of those questions, I am super pumped and excited to announce that I'm starting the Syndicator Incubator Mastermind Group. This mastermind is a group of highly motivated, abundance-orientated, hand-selected hustlers and entrepreneurs who are ready to take that next step in their investing career. We are now taking applications for the next group of champions. If you're interested to find out more, then email me at info@reedgoosens.com and put in the subject line, the Syndicator Incubator. Being a part of this mastermind group, you will have unlimited access to both myself and my business partner, Andrew Campbell, and you will understand how we have been able to build a portfolio of over 1,200 units worth over $120 million in under 24 months, and we've achieved financial freedom in the process. There are once a month mastermind calls with the group and a yearly conference where you will learn from the best in the business. So what are you waiting for? There are only limited spots, so get your application pack by emailing me at info@reedgoosens.com. And remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.
Hope is not a strategy. So when you buy for appreciation, you're hoping that somewhere in the future, somebody would be willing to pay more than you're willing to pay today. Everybody that made that decision in 2006 lost their shirt.
Welcome to Investing in the US, an Aussie's Guide to US Real Estate, a podcast for international investors and real estate entrepreneurs looking to break into the US market.
G'day, g'day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another cracking edition of Investing in the US podcast from Los Angeles. I'm your host, Reed Goosens. Good as always to have you with us on the show. Now, I'm glad that you've all tuned in to learn from my incredible guests, and each and every one of them are the cream of the crop here in the United States when it comes to real estate investing, business investing, and entrepreneurship. Each show, I try and tease out their incredible stories of how they have successfully created their businesses here in the US, how they've created financial freedom, massive amounts of cash flow, and ultimately created extraordinary lives for themselves and their families. Life by design, as I like to say. Hopefully, these guests will inspire all of my cracking listeners, which are you guys, to get off the couch and go and take massive amounts of action. If these guys can do it, so can you. Now, as you know, I'm all about sharing the knowledge with my loyal listeners, which is you guys, and there's absolutely no BS on this show, just straight into the nuts and bolts. Now, if you do like this show, the easiest way to give back is to give us a review on iTunes, and you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter by searching at Reed Goosens. You can find the show wherever you podcast, on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play, but you can also find these episodes up on my YouTube channel. So head over to reedgoosens.com, click on the video link, and it will take you to the video recordings of these podcasts where you can see my ugly mug, but the beautiful faces of my guests each and every week. All right, enough out of me. Let's get cracking and into today's show. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of speaking with Joseph Goslin. Joseph is a multifamily investment specialist at Eureka Business Group. He's the leading group acquisitions of over $30 million in real estate and providing asset management services to a portfolio of over 550 units and growing. Joseph is a former lieutenant in the Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, with over 17 years of leadership experience in the software industry, 12 of which have been working for publicly traded companies such as GameStop and JCPenney, which really enhanced his business acumen, analytical skills, and the big picture perspective, all skills which he has leveraged to maximize his efficiency in the real estate business world here in the United States. I'm really pumped and excited to have him on the show today to share his incredible experience and his insight. But enough out of me, let's get him out here. G'day, Joseph. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
Hey, Reed. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Mate, my pleasure. I saw a little bit in the green room, we're talking about your background, and
really interesting background because my wife is has been to Birthright, and she's not from Israel, but she was Jewish, and she's been back there a few times, and she tells me all the time that I need to go to Tel Aviv. But before we dive into Tel Aviv, do you want to rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first ever dollar as a kid?
Yeah, so probably was when I was 13 in the summer between summer break. I grew up in a family that was a single parent, and I wanted to contribute to that family income. So I went to work. I found a job in a toilet paper factory where we kind of manufactured the toilet paper and wrapped it. And I was loading it to the truck and unloading it on the route. And I was doing whatever I was needed to do.
At 13 years of age, right?
Yes, sir.
A true paper route, as they speak.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think about that.
Paper roll route, right? So awesome stuff. Well, tell me, you know, for those listeners out there who don't know, I know firsthand that the Israeli government requires Israeli population to do 2 years of military school. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how that has shaped you into, you know, where your path towards entrepreneurialism and your company that you have today?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Israel, like you said, it's mandatory service. Everybody, when they hit 18, almost everybody. And then men do 3 years, women do two. And if you volunteer to go to officer school, then you have an extra year regardless of gender. So I was an officer. I was in logistics. I got through the ranks and I got out of the military after 4 years of service as a second lieutenant. And really, I think a lot of the leadership experience that I've learned by commanding soldiers, and at some point I had a platoon of about 100 soldiers underneath me, it really helps you understand responsibility, really helps you understand what it means waking up before the first soldier and going to sleep after the last one. It helps you understand the intricacies of leading through influence over just authority, because everybody thinks military, you lead through authority, but it's not necessarily the same thing, because as an officer, sometimes you have enlisted people that have a 30-year career in their in the military that are under your command. So as a 19, 20, 21-year-old kid, now you got to command a 50-year-old enlisted man, a master chief or something like that, that have been in the military for the last 30 something years. So you can't just come in and use force or use authority. You got to work influence into your leadership skills as well. So I think I learned a lot from the military and my leadership skills really grew over there.
How many, given that I would say Israel is of the first world, you know, status, how many countries do you know still have requirement enrollment like Israel does? I don't think there's many in first world nations, right?
Very little in the first world.
It's such an interesting thing that, you know, growing up in Australia and probably people listening to this show growing up here in the United States to require everyone once you leave high school, right, that you go straight in for 2 years and then you go on to do university after that, correct?
Yes.
So it gives you such an it's a really incredible path, because I've met a lot of Israeli people from who have been backpacking around the world. They've, you know, they do the 2 years and they get out before they go back into university. And they're all just like so hungry to get out. But it must give you some pretty incredible skill sets. You know, I think you just talked to a little bit about that. But what's your sort of take on it? How have your other friends viewed being forced to go into the military at such a young age?
Yeah, so there's a few things to it, right? One of it is Israel is in a situation where it's needed. It's an existential thing. If we don't have a military, there will be no Israel, right? So you go defend the country, you go defend your home. It's your parents on the line. It's not you going to fight a war that is not your country. So that is a different mentality. The other thing is everybody else do that. So it's not like you're being forced, right? Your dad was in the military, your uncle is in the military, your cousins are in the military, your friends are in the military. It's just something everybody do. A lot of us don't look at it as being forced to go to the military.
Right. No, you're right. I probably used the wrong choice of words there, but all the Israeli folks that I've dealt with through business, because they have come through that military training, it seems that they're very straight to the point. They're very direct, and I like that being Australian because I'm very direct myself. And I think it cuts out the fluff and the BS, right? It's just like we're getting into it. You're either pull them a leg or you pull them a chain or you're not, and we've got to do business or we're not going to do business. Like it's none of this sort of courting, you know, relationship. It's none of the fluff. As I said, it's straight into the hard numbers and like, are we going to do business? Does this make sense for both of us? And if not, let's move on to the next person.
Well, right? This is definitely a military thing, right? Because when things are on the line, you don't have time for fluff. It's kind of like, mm-hmm. You got to say what you need when you need it and get it done fast, because there's literally lives on the line. So being a military society where almost everybody have been in the military, are in the military, or will be in the military, right? It's ingrained in the society. So that's why most Israelis you'll meet will be very straight to the point, straight shooters, assertive, and going through things. The other thing that I always say about military service, and that's true to the States as well, or any other military service that I've seen, is you send boys, you get men, right? Here in the United States, 18, 19, 20-year-old, they're still kids. They didn't get out of the house. They didn't understand what's going on. But when you get a rifle at 18 and you get the in situations where you might take another human's life, it makes you grow up really fast. So the responsibility, the seriousness of the situation kind of help you mature a lot faster. And you see that in Israel, it's hard to really differentiate, but over here in the States, you see a clear difference between a 24-year-old that got out of the military service and a 24-year-old that was not in military service.
You see? Right. No, I definitely can see that for sure.
So if you send boys, you get men.
Awesome stuff. So now, walk me through the transition of coming, you know, going into out of the military into the workforce, I should say, and then the transition to the United States. How did you come here? What's that journey look like?
Yeah, so when I grew up, I kind of grew up with the old story of go to school, get good grades, then military, and then go to the university, get your degrees, and hopefully you'll find a job that you'll stay there until pension. That's just my mother's mentality and the way she was raised and the world that she knew. But the world is not like that anymore. So I went into this path and I graduated with my software engineering degree. And I started working as a software engineer in a company that happened to have branches in multiple places around the world. And I knew I want to relocate to an environment where I can afford more for my kids, where I can give more, a better life quality to my family. And it was the United States or Australia that were both on the table. I felt more comfortable coming here to the States because we have some family over here, not in the immediate area, but in the country. So yeah, it's still better than nothing. We went on with relocating to the United States through my software job. That was
right.
2007.
And talk to me about how that must have been quite a shift, you know, moving halfway across the world into a new country that just you didn't know. You know, had you been here before you moved here?
I've been for a few short visits, but nothing, you know, too lengthy. A couple of weeks here, a couple of weeks there, maybe two or three times. But the Israeli environment, the Israeli society is very much ingrained or interlaced with the American culture. So we watch the same movies, we see the same shows, we listen to the same music. So it's kind of like it wasn't that much of a culture shock for me to do the transition. Plus, relocating to a branch of an Israeli company was definitely a good cushion to kind of land on, because there's a lot of other Israelis that did that before me.
Right. It's a sort of a bit of a soft landing, right? Not just coming here and, you know, trying to make it happen and look for a job and get housing and get your, you know, your kids into school and all that sort of stuff, which is, you know, a lot of people do it that way. So having that soft landing, coming through a company that you already knew and being surrounded by other Israelis from, you know, your home and similar humor, similar way of thinking, similar way of life, it's probably a way that, you know, helps ease the transition. And I know from personally, like, coming from Australia, I now have a great bunch of Aussie mates here because we have a similar thought process, right? And you sort of seek that out as being an expat in a foreign country. So tell me about the journey into real estate entrepreneur, you know, coming from a software engineer. It's such a big shift to going in and now running your own business.
Yeah, so the employee to a business definitely was a big shift, but one thing I noticed, and it's something that I still haven't explained, found an explanation for, is that there is a huge correlation between software people and real estate investors. There's a lot of software people that really love investing in real estate. My theory is that it's got to do with the fact that real estate is more predictable and easy to analyze, and you can see factor X impacting result Y. Versus stocks, where, you know, company could be doing great and their rumor comes in and the stock plummet, and then, you know, nothing happened really. So that's really, I think there's a correlation there. But I've always been interested in real estate. I read Rich Dad Poor Dad like everybody else when I was in college, and we had an opportunity to become an accidental landlord, really, back home, where my wife and I got married, and we just bought an apartment or a condo that was like 4 bedrooms, and we were just the two of us, no kids, and it was huge because we were living in the 1-bedroom apartment that we were renting. So it was kind of like, okay, do we move into this huge thing and start paying a lot more bills, or do we go the Rich Dad Poor Dad route, lease it out and stay in our little one? And then when you do that and, you know, rent comes in and you pay the mortgage and you pay the taxes and you pay the expenses and there's still something left at the end of the month, you go, huh, there's something to that real estate thing, right? That's how you start catching the real estate bug. And then we moved to the States in 07, which was like the absolute bottom where everything started blowing up all over around here. And my wife and I recognize that it's a huge opportunity. It's probably the best opportunity we will have in our lifetime. So we sold that apartment back home, moved the money over here, and started investing. And because it's a new country with new rules and new ways of doing things, we both went out and got licensed as real estate agents, just so we'll understand the environment and understand the rules and regulation and the process. So that's how we got started.
Awesome. That's such a great story, because I think I want to dive into the differences between the two countries, because I think it's really important for American listeners to hear just the state of Israel and it's the state of the real estate there and if cash flow exists versus here in the United States. But I think that the falling ass over backwards into the real estate game, that you bought this condo, you didn't know what the hell to do with it, but you decided to rent it out and you realized that you had cash flow. I think that's really a good lesson, but something that you were able to execute in Israel. So maybe let's talk a little bit about that first, you know, the investment space in Israel versus the United States. And did you see, when you came in 2007, was there a big contrast between the prices of what you could buy something in Israel for versus the prices you could buy here in the United States?
Yeah, so for American listeners, right, if you want to understand the Israeli real estate, think New York, Brooklyn, or California, LA. Urban, core urban, most of the country is, it's 3, 4 or more stories apartment buildings that are, it's condo buildings, basically, condominiums, and it's individual ownership. And Israel is super tiny space-wise, so there's not a lot of single-family homes. Single-family home is really very, very expensive in Israel, just like it would be if you're looking for a single family home in Beverly Hills, right? Or there are still a few kind of singles scattered around in Manhattan and Governor Island over there in New York, right? Good luck purchasing one of those. So that's really, Israel is like that, right? The single family homes are super expensive. Everybody buys an apartment. And I'm guessing it's a remnant of the Holocaust. There's that mentality of buying it's more desirable than renting. Here in the United States, people don't care buy or rent. They actually have a preference towards rent for a million different reasons. But that's really where we're different. Cost-wise, it's a lot more expensive to buy a property in Israel. Like, a lot more expensive. So we're talking, I don't know, 15 annual salaries or something like that in order to get a large enough for a family housing, right? So when we moved over here, we were kind of, first of all, we moved to Texas. So we didn't move to California or LA or Miami. So the cost of living here is a lot cheaper. The cost of real estate here is a lot cheaper. And that really helped us out with kind of make the decision. If we sell this thing over there, we can bring the money over here and buy more than what we could get over there. And I think the only reason that we were able to get a cash flow situation back home with the cost is we got help. My mom helped with the down payment, and we saved money, both of us, while we were working to put the down payment. And that's how we got a little bit of a cash flow. It wasn't a lot of a cash flow, but because we were living in a one-bedroom apartment, well below our means, it was a great opportunity.
Yeah, I think you highlighted and illustrated very well how the Israeli market is like the New Yorks and the Manhattan, the New Yorks and the LAs of the world. High appreciation markets, land is tight, things have to go vertical. There's a lot, the demand is higher than the supply. It's very similar to Australia. Australia has I tell people, think of the LA housing market across the entire country. Also, combined with that is that we have a lower population compared to the United States, and we can only inhabit a certain amount of our country because the rest is desert. Similar with Israel, your demand is very high, but the supply is very constrained. You have a population in a very small area, hence prices go through the roof. And so when I say to people, people are concerned that multifamily cap rates have come from 7.5 to 8% historically. Now they're down at 5 to 5.5. It's still such a good cap rate compared to what you would buy commercial real estate in Israel and Tel Aviv, or you would buy in Australia, in Sydney or Melbourne, similar to the LA and New York markets where cap rates are 2-3%. I think that's such a good thing just to hit on, because a lot of international investors come to the United States, particularly secondary markets like the Texas markets, with the fact that they can buy, their money goes a lot further, but they also they get a really pretty moderate cap rate on that purchase, and hence they can cash flow a lot better. Do you any comments on that?
Yeah, no, it's kind of like LA, New York, Miami, Seattle. These are
Chicago.
These are all appreciation markets, right? Go buy something in California that cash flows. It doesn't exist. Right? If you leverage it, you're not going to see any cash flow. So that's really the same way in Israel. Don't get me wrong, it's expensive, but if you bought something 10 years ago, it appreciated a lot. Mm-hmm. So it's just an appreciation market, just like any other appreciation market in the United States.
And so how do you combine that now with investing in a tertiary market or secondary market like Texas, where the appreciation might not be as great, but the cash flow is better? How do you sort of weigh the two up?
So for me, hope is not a strategy. So when you buy for appreciation, you're hoping that somewhere in the future, somebody would be willing to pay more than you're willing to pay today. Everybody that made that decision in 2006 lost their shit. That simple. So do you have a crystal ball to know if the market is going to dive tomorrow or there's a two, three more years? I don't have a crystal ball. So the only thing I know how to measure is today, if I buy it, am I going to cash flow? And if I'm going to cash flow, then how much? And that's the only thing I can measure. I can't guess what's going to happen tomorrow, right? Because here's the thing. If you bought something in, that is worth $1 million in 2010 and you paid $1.2 million, people would look at you and say, you're crazy. You paid $1.2 million. This is worth $1 million. Smash cat to 2017, it's worth 2.6, and all of a sudden you're a genius. You were crazy then, you're a genius now, right? But the fact is, you were just lucky. But if you bought a $1 million property in 2006 and you paid 1.2, smash cat to 2009, it's worth $600,000. Now, not only you were crazy, you were also stupid, right? But the reality is, no, you weren't either. You were just unlucky because you trusted hope, and hope is not a strategy.
Well, you bring up a very good point, and I want to ask you: were you tracking the Israeli markets when it, you know, you moved out here in 2007? Shit hit the fan in 2008. Did the Israeli market take a dive?
No, still haven't. By the way,
and I will add, Australia has not either. So let's keep in mind here that America took a dive housing wise, and just keep it in perspective, because a lot of other international countries, like even I know in Europe and in London, they didn't take as much of a hit as what the American markets did, based on the predatory lending that they did to lead us to bad debt. So we'll get into that in a minute. But I just wanted to, you're saying the Israeli market did not take a dive as much as the US market did in 2008.
At all.
Yeah. Well, that's nuts.
But here's the thing. No, it's not nuts, because you hit it on the head when you said it's the lending. The people that got this country in trouble the last time, and in my opinion, are the same guys that get this country in trouble now, right?
Right.
Is the banks. It's when somebody puts a super optimistic underwriting on the table and the bank is willing to bankroll that. That mm-hmm. is what happens. Back home right now in 2019, if you want to get a mortgage, you can only leverage up to 60%.
Hey guys, I just want to take a second to share with you our latest multifamily investment opportunity, the Broadwater at Salado Creek, located in San Antonio, Texas, the market where we've got the most experience in. Now, rapid fire, here are the reasons why we love this deal. It's got fantastic investor returns. We are projecting around 20% annualized investor returns for those people who choose to invest in this deal. The second thing is that all the 176 units are in classic condition, which means we can come in, use our renovation program, and push rents even higher. Thirdly, is that multifamily pricing for properties have fallen more today than they did during the 2008 global financial crisis. This could very well be the best time in the commercial real estate cycle to pick up cheap deals. Now, if you're interested, click in the description or reach out to me directly at reed@rsnpropertygroup.com. Now let's get back into the episode.
You can't leverage 80%. Back in 2004 and 5, you wanted to buy $100,000, you could get $120,000 to, you know, we'll throw in some for renovation. And if you want a new SUV, why not? Let's put it in the mortgage, right? I start seeing the flags coming in these days, like we saw them last time with emails from mortgage lenders saying zero down or stated income and all the kind of situations where got people in trouble. And that's really, I think, what was the downfall back then.
And you bring up a good point. Like, there's all, you know, the Dodd-Frank stuff that came in. It was, you know, rules and regulations around trying to be better with the lending sphere. Now we've got some murmurs from people saying, well, it's too restrictive and loans aren't getting done. Well, aren't we just going to go and history repeats itself? Like, we just go back to that being silly lending and, you know, people, oh, you got a pulse, you can fog a mirror, here you go.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes you got to protect the people from themselves. What brought this country to its knees is the subprime lending. It's the people that shouldn't have gotten a loan and got a loan anyways. It's the same people that go out and buy a new car when they can barely pay rent. And you know, just a short story kind of to illustrate that, we bought a 22-unit apartment building a few years ago. And when we buy an apartment building, we walk every unit as part of the inspection process. And I'm walking this, property, 22 units. Every single one of those tenants have a bigger TV than mine, but I'm the one buying the building.
Right.
Right. And it's not like I have a 14-inch TV. Okay. So that's just priorities. That's what it is. And understanding finances. Nobody teaches finances here.
I was just going to jump in. Sorry to jump in there, but I think you bring up a good point. But also, it's a double-edged sword there, right? Like, you have the wants and needs of the American dream being shoved down everyone's throat of, like, you need to own this, you need to own that, consumerism 101 just getting pumped into, you know, the market of the, you know, I've always viewed America as just like, why do you need, I remember one time, a classic example of, like, I came to the United States back in 2008 or something, and I was watching a television commercial about a hamburger, and you get a hamburger with bacon on it, but it was doused in brown sugar, and I was like, why do you need that? Like, it's sort of like, why do you need, and it's an example of, like, why do you need the 58 or 72 or 108-inch TV? You know, like, the whole, we need more, we get an iPhone, we chuck it out, we get a TV, we chuck it out, we get a bigger one. And it's, I don't know, something about the American psyche about keep buying, right? Keep buying, keep buying, keep buying. And so I think we're all sucked into that with the little carrot at the end of the stick. But we're also, on the other hand, you've got the people, the policymakers, who are making it easier for people to get loans, to get really cheap financing, and to essentially build up all this debt. And all of a sudden it crashes. So I think there's a double-edged sword, and there's responsibilities on both sides of the fence. Yes, there's a financial education piece, but secondly, you know, the shark lending, and you've got to buy this TV, you've got to buy this new car, but you can't even afford to live in your apartment. You've got to meet somewhere in between. And I don't think it's all just the consumer's fault. So just wanted to, you know, throw that my two cents in there and get your opinion on that, because being an international person, you probably think a little bit the same as what I do about just, like, why you shake your head at some of the things that you see here and how cheap you can get. Like, why do you need that?
Yeah, and there's a big difference between need and want, right? And
a lot of
society right now is running on want versus on need. And and sometimes you got to take a step back and say, okay, what do I need? What do I want? And how do I get there? And at some point I understand putting regulations, but the American concept of capitalism is, if you're stupid, you're gonna fall, and if you're smart and you can make it, you'll make it. That's what makes this country great. It's competitive. It's ingenious, right? It's innovative things to do. And that usually happens, but the banks let
on the flip side, you get people consuming and stupid things coming out with loan wise, and then that, oh, I need to be, the want and the need thing that you had, like you just said, I need the four houses, the four bedrooms, I need the landscape, I need the pool, I need the car, but I can't afford to pay for it. Right. So yeah, it's interesting concept. Tell me a little bit about what you're building right now at Eureka. I think it's such an awesome thing to do. And we sort of glossed over a little bit that transition from, visa, you know, non-immigrant into being your own boss, because I've been down that path as well. So I'm sure we've got a lot in common.
Yeah, so I came in on software. I got licensed, but I was still working in software. And then over time, you know, you spend your time and then you apply for a green card. And I was lucky enough to have a company that was willing to sponsor a green card. And once you have a green card, clocks are ticking. 5 years later, you apply for citizenship. But throughout that, I was having a software career. And I was investing in real estate. And even though we were licensed, we didn't do a lot with the license, just our transactions and maybe a few friends and family kind of that we wanted to help. But we really, really fast realized that we don't like the residential real estate business, because it's too emotional. There's too much fluff. It's kind of like, well, I don't like this house because the door is red. Well, yeah, I'll buy you a new door. It's a $500,000 house and it's a $130 door, right? That's the kind of things that I just couldn't handle. I'm a very analytic, business-oriented numbers guy. So that's really where somewhere in 2015, in conjunction with some of my single-family rentals generating a lot of CapEx expenses at the same time, I said, okay, that's not scalable. What can we do? And being an engineer, I did a very thorough analysis of every asset class out there and landed on multifamily. And we can talk about the reasons why I think multifamily is the best asset class to get into. But that was a decision. And then that's how we started acquiring. And some of the acquisitions included bringing investors from the outside and raising capital for it and buying larger apartment complexes. And some of it was building the brokerage to handle the commercial real estate and the multifamily specifically in a way that created a unique environment for us where we can offer the brokerage customers a lot of the experience we gained on the acquisition. So we've done different kind of loans and we bought different sizes of properties and we went through the process multiple times. So now when we have a buyer, we can help them through the process. So when we have a seller, we can help them maximize the proceeds from selling their property.
Interesting. No, I think it's such a great concept you've got into because you've also maximized your business ecosystem, right? You can help them on both the entry side and also the investment side, which I think is really having a double prong approach really will recession proof your business, I think. So, you know, you mentioned about the best asset class to invest in multifamily. As you have seen, you know, firsthand that 2007, the cap rates were at a different stage than what they are today. You're also investing in the tertiary, secondary markets, which we talk about Texas, and we talked about the differences between, you know, Israel and Australia versus the secondary markets. So where, in your opinion, where's it all headed? Like, can we keep compressing these cap rates? Can they keep going to 3-4% in these, you know, Dallases and Texases and North Carolinas of the world? Like, what's your thought process or what's your opinion on that?
So I'm a little bit of an odd duck in the environment when I talk about cap rate, right? So you're talking about purchase cap rates. And in my opinion, purchase cap rates are irrelevant. And I try to help a lot of investors and buyers understand that. If I offer you a skyscraper downtown Sydney for $1 million, are you buying it?
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. What if it's vacant? You still buying it?
100%, yeah.
But it's a zero cap rate. It's a horrible deal.
Right.
No, it's not. It's a skyscraper for $1 million. Get me two of those, please, right?
Right. Yeah.
So the cap rate, when you look at the purchase and the actuals, is not really relevant. What's relevant is what value can you generate out of this property? If I buy it for a 4 cap, but I can make it an 8 cap with some CapEx investment, then I got an 8 cap asset. I didn't get a 4 cap asset.
It's interesting you bring that up because I think that I see a lot of people and even when I educate my investors as well is like, we're buying it at X cap rate, but you have to look at the stabilized cap rate. What, you know, maybe look at year two or year three and divide that NOI by your purchase price and you'll probably be more in the mid sixes, right? And more towards a normalized cap rate. What are you educating people on that, looking at that sort of year two or year three NOI versus the going in?
Yeah, so we're actually doing a full projection all the way through 7 and 10 year because we're always long-term hold the period. And like I said, it comes down to the owner's P&L is the owner's P&L. If the owner's brother-in-law is the pest control guy and he gets it for cost, I'm going to have to pay retail.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a real life example from last week. One of my clients bought a 20 unit property in the same city. We own about 500 units, right? And he calls me and say, hey, how much I need to replace an AC unit. And I think this quote is too high. And I reach out to my team and I realize that for me, it was very high. And I realized that, yeah, of course it's too high because I only pay for parts. My AC certified maintenance guys do the work, but he has to get a retail AC technician to do the work. So my scale allows me to have a cheaper cost of doing things than the guy that has 20 units. At the same time, I know a guy that owns 2,500 units in the same town. His cost of doing things is half as much as what I pay.
Yeah.
So if I'm looking at the big guy P&L, I'll never be able to achieve that. It might show 8 cap and then I'll walk in and it'll be a 4 cap because I have to pay a lot more for expenses.
I'm interrupting this episode to remind you guys about the Syndicator Incubator Mastermind Group. If you want to take your investing career to the next level and surround yourself with the best in the business, then apply today. Spots are filling up fast. I'm only taking a handful of people for the next round, so get your application by emailing me at info@reedgoosens.com. Remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack. Now back into the show.
So then how do you talk about the exit in 10 years time? Like, so if you're buying it at a 4 cap, are you got to, you know, we've got to put a yardstick somewhere. It's a, it, you know, an Excel spreadsheet is not a crystal ball, but you have to assume an exit cap rate in terms of getting an exit price. So are you using an expansion on the going in cap rate? And just to all the listeners out there, Joseph was saying that you have to look at the owners. The current owner's P&L may be different to your P&L, and hence you might be picking up at a 4, but you might be able to stabilize at a 6 or a 7. So what are you then coming year 7, year 10, what are you choosing the cap rate to be? And is it based off that going in cap rate, or is it based on more like a market prediction in X period of time later?
Well, neither actually. So what I do is I look at, we buy all value add. Right. So the entry cap rate will always be lower than the current stabilized cap rate. So what I do is I'm looking at, if this property was fully stabilized right now, today, what would be the cap rate? Let's say it's 6. Then I take that and I add a full point. So I'll predict a 7 cap rate. And that gives me, for example, if you're looking at a $10 million deal going out down 7-10 years, this could mean $1 million that you take off the table just by adding that.
Sure. Yeah.
So we'll go on the conservative side. I know some sponsors that only add a quarter point or half a point. Some of them don't do any changes. They take the stabilized cap rate and keep it the same, which I think is very bold or optimistic. But then again, I can't prove them wrong. I don't have a crystal ball. Maybe it will stay flat for the next 10 years.
Right. No, but it's also the where is, I think it's got to, you've got to come into what you were saying about the market cap rate if the asset was stabilized, right? And then growing it from that market cap rate stabilization. I'll also add that, and this is getting quite complex now, but with the transition, particularly in Texas, and I know this because I'm invested there, the tax rates are going through the roof, and you buying a cap rate, you buying an asset with a new adjusted tax rate, you're going to have a different NOI and hence a different entry cap and then hence a different exit cap than the person is in place today. So keep that in mind, and I'm going to repeat it again. It's called a reversion cap rate, and you need to look at, understand what that is, because you're not comparing apples to apples. If you look at their P&L and they've owned it for 20 years, they're going to have a lot lower tax basis than I'm going to buy it in 2019. So I need to adjust my quote-unquote NOI of the first year based on their current operations versus my tax rate that I'll probably have to pay because the value's gone up and in the transition. I know Texas is a non-disclosure state. However, they always seem to bloody find out. And they always come knocking at your door and say, hey, it's now 95% of the purchase price and you paid, you know, $7 million more than what she paid for or the person paid for 10 years ago. So you owe, you know, you owe an extra $400,000 in taxes. That's going to have a huge impact on your NOI and have a huge impact on your cap rate. So just keep that in mind. I just want to take that. And do you have any comments on that, you know, about the reversion cap rates of adjusting it for taxes?
Yeah, I'm just going to pull the Texan in me and tell everybody how Texas is really awesome. Not just by being a non-disclosure state where they can't just know your sales price. They're going to have to kind of guess it. But we just had a state tax law voted in that property taxes cannot go up by more than 3.5% without voters' approval. So Texas is awesome. Come to invest in Texas.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'll counter that by saying that I have looked at three assets in the last 2 weeks, and I put NOIs on it. The whisper price is less than what the county has assessed it for, which means that you're paying, if you know how to do the calculation, it's a percentage multiplied by the mill rate multiplied by the purchase price, which means that percentage is over 100%. So you've got to go and then argue with the county. And so the way in which you argue with them, say, and this is what a lot of counties I'm seeing are doing, they're just jacking your price and saying, hey, it's worth this, prove it to me otherwise. And all our tax attorneys are saying, well, the way you prove it to them, give me a bloody freaking closing statement, and they'll take 95% of that. So I love your optimism about Texas, but the fact is they don't have an income tax. They got to get it from somewhere, and they're being really aggressive. I know Bexar County and in Travis County in Austin are being extremely aggressive, because I've also seen law coming into place about your maximized year-on-year growth that the counties can charge. So they're all trying to flood the market and say, hey, now you're now worth $40 million when you're actually only paying $30 million for it. And so they just say, prove it. And so the only way you prove it based on our lawyer's recommendation is give them the closing statement. They then know what you paid for it. So it's a real dichotomy now. And this is why a lot of the deals I'm seeing in my space, the sort of B plus area, are just not penciling, because you can't, the taxes are doing these, loop to loop sort of roller coaster. And you're like, where the hell's it? It's like throwing a dart at a dartboard. Where's it going to land up? So any comments on that? Because I wanted to be the opposite, the devil's advocate, because I've definitely seen stuff where it's like, that's not worth what the county's saying it's worth.
Well, but that's easy, because there are a lot of really good tax people that can go to fight for you. And every time we employed one of those, they justify their fees, right? They only get paid if they reduce your tax liability, right? So the good ones can really make a big difference. But you're right. Underwriting is super important, that when you look at the property and you underwrite it, you underwrite that tax jump, because it will happen. There's no doubt it will happen. It's just a matter of when it will happen. And some counties are more aggressive than others, right? Travis, Dallas, Collin County. Oh my God, Collin County is one of the most aggressive ones out there. But the secondary Texas markets are a little less aggressive, because they know they're going to have to work with people to bring investments into town. So in certain areas, we'll do 85% of purchase price. In some areas, like Dallas or Collin, right, we definitely go to 95% because we know that's what's going to happen really, really fast. They don't sit on it. They just go right at it. And in case people try to figure out, well, how do they know how much you pay? You're going to have a loan. And that loan is recorded with the county, so the county will know how much loan you have. They'll reverse engineer that.
Yep, exactly. And then you hit the nail right on the head there. That's exactly how they assess the taxes. So back to my original question, because we sort of roundabout way, it was like, where's multifamily going? Because taxes are starting to go through the roof, which are making deals not, you can't pencil them like they used to. So we can't just keep going up and up and up. Are we in a world where Dallas and Austin's and San Antonio's and Houston's are going to be, over the next 10, two, three decades, sub 6% cap rates? Are we ever going to get back to the pendulum swing of back to a 7 or an 8?
Yeah.
In the market, stabilizing the market, I mean.
Yes, but not for the reasons you might think. So the terms of the United States is so big, you can't really talk about the United States as a market, right? There's markets like Denver and North Dallas and Austin that are overly built, right? There's a lot of new units being released. And there's other markets in the country that are still way underbuilt. So there are still areas in this country where you can find those 7 and 8%, but they're not going to be in places you've heard of, right? That's one thing. The other thing is,
I'm talking about true growth markets. Let's exclude the tertiary markets, because that's higher risk. I'm talking about the downtown Dallas, downtown Austin, downtown Houston's, where prices have got historically been in the 7 and 8%, and they're now in the sub 5. Will they ever get back to that in those markets? Excluding the speculative oil towns in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, no, but you also, you say exclude risk, but cap rate is all about risk.
Sure.
So it's always a correlation to the risk. So if you're looking at core MSA, let's say top 30 markets, you will continue to buy them at the 3, 4, 5 cap rate, but you can take these properties, and with the fact that millennials want to rent and people are still moving to the center of the cities and the urban environments become a lot more vibrant than it used to be in the past. It's not just business oriented downtown, right? Then I think rents will continue to grow and demand is going to continue to grow, but your 4 cap purchase will become a 6 and a 7 over time. So that's really where I think this is going. I also feel that since the Regulation D came out in 2012, 2013, a lot of people got into this business, and out of them, the 80-20 rule always worked, right? 80% of them will probably fail. They'll fail on operation. And in multifamily, I keep telling everybody, you make your money when you buy, but you lose your money on operations. Mm-hmm. That second half still haven't sunk and still haven't raised his head. Because like I said earlier, if you buy something that's worth $1 million for $1.2 million, but the market just shot up since 2009, you're a genius. You could fumble every possible operation decision and still make a ton of money because rents just went up and up and up and up month over month. But now anybody that buys now when the market is pretty close to the top and we're seeing some of the properties already back out their rent because they pushed it beyond what the market could bear, that is when operation becomes super critical. And efficiency and cost reduction is as important as rent because you can't push rent anymore.
Right. No, it's a good, very good point. Very good point. Keep going.
I feel a lot of these operators that have never been taught how to operate and they're not super efficient at operation, the lack of rent growth is going to cause them to spiral down and lose a property. So I do feel that's just my personal opinion. In the next 2-3 years, we're going to see a lot of distressed sales coming up on the market, not because of a market shift, but because of bad operators.
No, I think that's a very good point to put out to a lot of people. There has been a ton of people in this market in the multifamily space, which has been, but it's also caused a lot of frothiness, right? And people paying. I just saw a 1980s deal trade for a 4 cap in San Antonio. I was like, who the hell paid that for that? Like, it's just not worth that. And this is a stabilized 90% plus type of deal. I mean, there's value add to be had. People are still trying to make it work. So with all that being, what's that?
There's other factors there, right?
Sure, so, there's other factors.
Like when you focus on core MSAs, you use your top 30 market, you talk about names of places that are known worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of Chinese money and Japanese money and German money that came to Dallas in the last 4 or 5 years is incredible. And some people have different agendas than you. You're looking to buy something so you can make good returns for your investors. Some of the Chinese money is just to get the money out of the country.
Right.
Japanese investors have this weird tax law that says if they buy anything over 20 something years old, they can write it off in 3 years. There was a transaction recently in Dallas, $30 million paid cash, 3 cap.
What was it? Yeah, but and you bring up a very good point because I want to go back to, and this is for all the listeners out here. And I'm diving deep on this because we're all talking about cap rates compressing, but both of us, and this is to the listeners, we've come from markets where if you double, and I can personally speak to myself, if you in Australia, we were always taught if you double your money in 10 years, that is a real bloody good return. people have been used to in the last 5 to 6 years doubling their money in 3 years. We are not in a market where that happens anymore. I just did a two-part series on readjusting investors' expectations. And so how do we compete with the Chinese and the Germans of the world and, you know, the big companies coming in, scooping them all up? Well, you have to realize that we are, if you're buying in core MSAs and you're looking at a 10-year growth period and you're doubling your money in, call it 8 to 9 years, that's still a, and you can cash flow a little bit along the way, and you're looking at your equity multiple rather than purely cash flow in a top 30 market. That's a really, that's a long-term vision. Things are continuing to rise. Rents are going to continue to go up. I don't think I've ever seen insurance rates go down. You know, so in the world where insurance is still going to go through the roof, guess what else is still going to go through the roof? Rents. Now, rents are going to, you know, it's like a plane taking off, going through a bit of turbulence. They may dip a little bit but are they going to crash over the long period of time? No, they're not. And the cost of living is going to continue to rise. Inflation is still going to happen. And people talk about inflation in the market. We're seeing it. The fact that rents are going, you know, your car payment's going up, your gas is going up, you know, things are, other things in the market are inflating in and around, not necessarily the flat inflation rate that they calculated on. And the reason I say that is that you have to have a long-term mindset. And Joseph, I know that I speak to you when the reason international money comes to these markets and for, you know, pay silly amounts of money for it is because they have that long-term vision. And then in 10, 15, 20 years, their money is going to quadruple. And they just they're patient. And a lot of investors that probably you and I deal with aren't patient. And we've lost patience in this game. And it's all, and you got to remember, it's not get rich quick, but a lot of people have got rich quick in the last 3 years, and I think that's going to be the norm going forward. And I just really want to drive that home, because all the factors we've talked about, taxes, you know, cap rates, interest cap rate, you know, all that sort of stuff comes back to the point that you're trying to hit a return for your investors that maybe is a little bit inflated based on expectations the last 5 years. Joseph, any comment? Because I've just put a lot of, you know, made a lot of statements there. What are your thoughts on that? That was just my two cents. I had to get it off the chest.
No, you're absolutely right here. There's no doubt that the last 6-7 years have caused some really extreme expectations with investors out there. Real estate is a long game. It's not a short term. And that's why the short term mentality is what caused the term cycle to come in. Real estate is not a cycle. Cycle is something that goes back to zero. But real estate doesn't go back to zero if you look at it as a long term. If you look at a 6 to 10 year period, yes, real estate goes back to zero. But if you look at it from a longer perspective, 10, 15, 20, 30 years, there's not a single property in the United States that sells today at the same price it was sold in the 80s. It just doesn't exist, right? Everybody that bought in 2006 at the absolute top were back to zero around 2017, 2018. And the market's still going up, right? You just had to have enough pockets to carry through that downfall, right? But the point is that if you play a short term, you're gambling. You might or might not hit that, or you might lose a lot more, right? But if you're playing a long game, if you cross the 10-year mark, the chances of you losing money in real estate are not very high.
Yeah, I think I'm just writing this down. If you're playing the short-term game, you're gambling. I think that's exactly right. And you've got to look at it from a long-term point of view. And both you and I come from markets in countries where, you know, getting a 10% IRR over 10 years is fantastic, you know, and doubling your money. So getting these 18, 19, 20%, they're great if you can get them, but they shouldn't be every single time you step up to the plate and try to take a swing, because you're gonna start, as you said, you're going to start gambling now and you're going to start losing. And we're coming to long in the tooth and the markets are starting to adjust. And so how are you going to prepare for that downturn? And people still want to place capital. So it's very interesting about how, you know, different strategies about how people still want to buy multifamily, but we've got to buy in growth markets and strong MSAs With that is low risk, lower risk. So with that is going to have lower return expectations. So things have got to give, right? And it's all about between you and I on this show and you talking to your investors, we've got to educate investors about it and get the message out there. So so good stuff. Mate, I've been talking to you for nearly an hour. I love it. I want to be really respectful of your time. I'm ready to dive into the top five investing tips. You want to get going?
Yeah, sounds good.
Mate, what is the daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
So really keeping an eye on the ball is super important in this business, right? I've seen a lot of investors or asset managers that just hand over the keys to the property management and try to forget about it, and it just doesn't work. So I have a daily report that my admin is generating for all of our properties. It's been sent to me and my partner and to all of the on-site managers and the property management regional and so on, where we keep eye on the ball. We're looking at factors like what's the vacancy and what's the debt collection and how many notices did we get. So we track it on a daily basis. And for me, that's super critical to kind of make sure that we don't lose track of it and go to sleep for a few weeks and all of a sudden, wait a second, why are we 5% less in occupancy? What happened? Where did all these people go? Right?
Right.
So that's one thing that we do daily is kind of make sure we keep an eye on the ball.
Awesome. Love it. And I think, yeah, you're exactly right. Vacancy, debt collection, and what you're saying about debt collection is your delinquency, you know, who's behind on rent. For those people listening, notices to vacate are a huge thing, particularly in multifamily. If you own a 50 unit property or 100 unit property and you get 10 tenants coming in saying, hey, I'm leaving next month, well, crap, you're 90% occupied, or if you're at 100%. So you need to go fill that. You need to either try and get them to renew, or you got to try and fill them, you know, as it's coming down the line. And we look at that a lot as well, like what's your renewal rate and what's your exposure coming over. And particularly in the summer, it's always higher than it is in the winter, but something for people to take note of. Mate, who has been the most influential person in your career to date?
Just
in life. Who's been the most influential?
Well, I have a few that I kind of collected over the years that have been go-to people, right? When I have a question, I have a friend / peer / mentor that have been doing a multifamily for the last decade. And he's had his up and downs and you know, sometimes I call to get advice. Sometimes I call to share some new things that we're doing and we're working. And sometimes I just call to vent and, he'll go, oh yeah, this happened to me when I did this, or this is how you get out of it. So he's probably one of my go-to guys. I also have my business partner, which I talk to almost on a daily basis, kind of, it's important to that. And that was one of my biggest lessons from my first syndication is I did that one alone, soup to nuts. And it was a lot. And it was very stressful having a business partner. And I had him since then, right? Since my second syndication, to be able to use it as a soundboard and to someone to question your decisions and someone to kind of work through some challenges together and get ideas that might not come across your mind is huge. So I guess these are the two people that we can talk about.
Awesome. No, I think that's if you want to give their names and a shout out, then please do. But if not, that's okay as well.
Okay.
What is the most influential tool in your real estate business, whether it be software or hardware related?
So my entire life is in Trello.
Nice.
Trello. It's a website, Trello.com. They have an app. It's basically a fancy sticky note system where you can assign to a team member. You can put a deadline. You can color code it. You can build multiple lists and add cards to it. But really, one of the most important features of that one, that the way I use it, is I have a brain dump list. So I might be talking to you and then something super critical that I forgot to do or I need to do comes up. I'll say, hey, give me a second. I'll brain dump it into my to sort list, right? And then I'll continue with what I was focused on. It helps me stay focused on task while not losing track of things, right? So that's one of the features I love most about using this tool, is that I can brain dump and then circle back to what I'm thinking. And then just being able to work with all my team is remote. So just being able to collaborate with them over this without constant communication and emails is huge, because it also keeps track of all the comments back and forth and statuses.
Love it. I love it. We use Slack, very not as project management related, but it keeps things sort of a little bit more organized. Trello. There's another one I've also called, I'm going to blank right now. Master Sheets is another one. Smart Sheets, I should say, is another one. And Monday.com. There's a few ones out there that do some really good stuff.
Yeah, we use Slack too, but it's more for real-time communication, a lot less messaging. For organizing tasks.
Exactly. Yeah, good stuff. Mate, what has been, in one sentence, what has been the biggest failure in your career to date, and what did you learn from that failure?
That's a good question. I probably am a little bit too paranoid. So I don't know if you would call it failure, but I wish I would have figured out multifamily over single family a lot sooner. I wish I was buying more aggressively back in 2010, 2011, 2012. So failing to recognize that we're over the bottom and we're shooting up and it's a good opportunity, that's probably the biggest failure I can point to.
2020 hindsight, right? It's always the way.
I wish, yeah.
Mate, last question is, where can people reach you to continue the conversation? They want to find out a little bit more about you, what you do, be in your sphere. Where do they go?
Yeah, so I'm very visible. If you just Google my name, you'll see all my social media channels and everything. But the best way to find us is to go to our website, ebgtexas.com. EBG for Eureka Business Group, Texas like the state, so ebgtexas.com. And my contact details are there, and my phone number, my email. I'm very easy to find.
Awesome, mate. Well, look, I want to thank you for dropping in today and just dropping a lot of knowledge bombs on us. I think it was pretty cool. Some of the things I took away, probably the top three things, was hope is not a strategy. And you know, hoping that things are going to go up is not a strategy. Purchase cap rates are irrelevant if you know what the P&L is supposed to be at, where it's at a stabilization, and looking at, you know, year two, year three cap rates over a 7 or 10 year hold, and understanding that's probably more a realistic cap rate of where the asset will stabilize at, I think is really important. And if you're playing the short term, you are gambling. I think that was probably the biggest thing that I took away from today. And I think a lot of people are still trying to play the short term, get in for 2-3 years and then get out and hope to make a bunch of money. And as we're approaching the corner of the recession, I think that's a pretty risky business. But mate, did I leave anything out? Any last comments?
No, I think you nailed it. I think I might repeat just one sentence that I said.
Sure.
You make your money when you buy, but yes, you lose your money on operations.
Yes.
That's super critical.
Make your money when you buy it and you lose your money on operations. Yeah, 100%. And we could have a whole, I'd love to get you back and talk a lot about getting out of the gate, if that makes sense correctly, once you bought the asset. And if you have that slow start, it can just, you're constantly playing catch up. But that's for another topic, another day altogether. Mate, thank you so much for dropping by. Enjoy the rest of your week and we'll catch up soon.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, there you have another cracking episode jam-packed with some incredible advice from Joseph. If you do want to get involved in any of the stuff he's doing, get in his sphere, please head over to egbtexas.com. That's E for Edward, G for George, B for Bravo, Texas.com. Sorry, EBG, other way around. E for Edward, B for Bravo, G for George, Texas.com. And I want to thank you all for taking some time out of your day to tune in to continue to grow your investing knowledge, because that's what we're all about here on this show, in teaching you to increase your financial IQ. And we're going to do it all again next week. So be bold, be brave, and remember, go give life a crack.